Paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. This morning we're here with Tammy Flanagan. Tammy Flanagan, the name the name precedes the name. Tammy Flanagan, Senior Benefit Director, NITP, Weekly GovExec columnist, fellow seminar presenter of, has it been 20 years?
It's been 20 years in May, more than 20 years.
Wow.
All right. Time flies.
And myself, Bob Lines, I'm a tax finance type with NITP, and I do seminars with Tammy. And we're here this morning to talk about benefits for working for Uncle Sam. Now, benefits, not necessarily just the benefits, the benefit of, which would include the benefits as well as the job challenge and the opportunity to change jobs and the like. So I don't know that one should ever go to work for, quote, dollar benefits. They ought to like their job. And the federal sector allows you to choose from just about any job that there is. You might not get it right away, but the point is get in.
Yeah, there's seems to be a lot of jobs available out there. If you go to usajobs.com, it's just, or .gov, I guess it is, a huge number of opportunities. I think some of them probably have long waiting lists to get in, but others I think are pretty available, especially if you're willing to relocate to the area where the jobs are.
So we're going to talk about that. Not necessarily in particular. We're going to drill more into the actual financial rewards as well as the psychological rewards, the job security in an environment where there maybe isn't a lot of job security in the private industry. And you're talking to two veterans, if you will. I mean, we're at least 20 years out of high school. If we look back on our careers, where we're very happy with what we did, sometimes in the back of your head, you say, gee, I wonder what it would be like if we had stayed and worked for Uncle,
because both of us have. I would have had my 30 years in this year.
30?
Yeah. I started in 1980 working for the government. Years out of high school.
I think I would have had 42, and I probably wouldn't be sitting behind this mic.
That's right. You'd be down on a beach in Florida by now.
Okay.
We have our maybe a few regrets about the choices we made, but I think we had to put some thought into that, and I think what we're doing now makes a whole lot of sense in both of our situations. But I always tell the classes that the next best thing to being a federal employee, at least, is to be married to one. So in my case, at least I have the federal health benefits and the federal retirement benefit through my husband, which is a nice thing to feel secure about.
Yeah. Yeah. You wrote an article, of course, for GovExec, I think it was just a few weeks ago, and it was called New Employee Orientation. So this isn't necessarily designed just for new employees. This could be anybody entering the federal sector.
No, I met somebody yesterday over the weekend who has 20 years of service and still, I know, doesn't have a good handle on the benefits of his federal career. So
I'm
spent
amazed.
A few minutes talking about that.
And talking to people outside of the classroom. Of course, once they're in the classroom, they know they have a retirement. But the people that have yet to be at a retirement seminar or have heard about one and listened to the show or other things in the agency, they don't know that they have a benefit.
Well, you know, I've even met, in fact, this is almost a weekly occurrence. I meet people every day, especially only under FERS. CSRS, this never happens, but under the FERS system, I'll meet people who, by the time we get to the lunch break of the seminar, they'll ask me what I was talking about all morning. I'll say,
no.
What do you mean? And they said, well, you were talking about our retirement, and it didn't sound like you were talking about the thrift plan or Social Security. I says, no, I wasn't. I said, I was talking about your FERS retirement benefit, like your company pension. And they'll look at me bewildered and say, I didn't know I had a company pension. I said, well, we don't call it that, but they call it your FERS basic retirement benefit. And I realize, I think the reason why some people are in the dark about that is, number one, it's not really covered or at least strongly emphasized in employee orientations in many cases. And when you look at your leave and earning statements, where you see all the withholdings that come out of your paycheck, the withholding for that FERS retirement benefit is less than 1% of your salary. I mean, what could 1% contribution really mean to your future? And I think what employees need to realize is that even though they're only paying in 1%, the agencies are contributing 11.5% of payroll to fund that future benefit. It has a lot more value than most people realize. And so, it's something that if you work in private industry, 9 times out of 10, you're not going to have.
Now, you have an interesting stat in your article. And by the way, if you want to read our article, which is outstanding like all of them, go to our website, nitpinc.com. We don't farm emails or sell email lists. nitpinc.com, left-hand side, and read the Tammy Flanagan's article. Just click on, because every one of them is archived. And this is no more than 3 weeks. That's his new employee orientation.
The month of May, I think I did it. Yeah.
Okay, 4 weeks. And you have a good stat in here. Only 20% of all private sector workers were offered traditional pensions in 2007.
Yeah, they're very hard for companies to fund, as they've come to realize after having them for so many years. But I guess the benefit of the federal government is that through the budgeting process and tax revenues, you know, there's at least so far enough funding to cover our retirement benefit well into the future.
And that percentage gets smaller when you go to companies with less than 100 workers.
Oh, yeah. They wouldn't offer a pension benefit, I wouldn't think.
So,
yeah, for most employees out in the private sector, your retirement is called save. This is like, because for people who are well compensated, Social Security may, if you're lucky, replace 25% of your income. And the rest of it's going to come from your 401k or your 403b or whatever those other numbers are that the IRS likes to use.
Alphabet soup.
Yeah.
But, and your point is well taken, because savings is one thing, but if you have a higher salary, you don't get to save dollar for dollar what that higher salary is, because you're going to lose a certain percent. And I bet that's going to be 25 to 33% to taxes before you can save.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to save once the cash hits the checking account. It's got to come out beforehand.
That's right. So you know, with the traditional retirement plan back in the 80s when FERS was being designed and, you know, when CSRS was starting to be phased out, was what they used to call a three-legged stool. And that's what we have under FERS. We have the three legs, Social Security and savings, the TSP, and a pension. And that still exists today for all federal employees who are covered under FERS. With the CSRS system, it's a one-legged stool.
Strong one-legged stool.
But it goes pretty high in the sky. So, yeah, I don't think there's anything to complain about if you're under the old CSRS system, other than if you left early and gave up the benefit, as you and I did.
Yes, we did.
But that's water under the bridge.
Yeah, such that it is. And then the other thing that it offers, and we are a pre-retirement, mid-career, beginning career seminar company, so we don't want to sound like we're always talking about retirement. But I've just noticed in the last year and even last week, I saw some 20-year-olds in the pre-retirement seminar and some 30-year-olds. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I always go up, and people listening to this show probably tired of hearing them, but I ask them the same question, what are you doing in here? And the response is, some of it doesn't have direct application, but the others do. And I want to make sure I have my finances in order early on in my life rather than trying to play catch-up in my 40s or 50s.
Yeah, or they'll say, my boss made me come.
Which is a good thing.
Which is a good thing. It's a caring boss that said, you know, you need to hear this stuff now so that you're not going to be regretful about it later. And they'll even have coworkers in the audience, and they'll say, why are these young people here? And I'm like, they're the ones who should be here. I says, once you're 3 years away from retirement, sometimes it's a little late to go back and make changes that are going to take years to recover from, you know, mistakes you may have made in the past.
Right. And then the other thing that it offers, among many things, is discounted health care.
Yeah.
Well discounted health care. And I was riding down this morning listening to WTOP News, of course, and they were talking about the cut in Medicare reimbursements to doctors. And they talked about the number of doctors just this year that are just saying, we don't accept any more Medicare
patients. It's becoming a real problem.
Yeah, huge problem. And this was before the 21% cut. So, and here you have a nice retirement system, you have a great healthcare system, and we can talk about the thrift and the like after that.
Yeah.
But let's say somebody...
Well, the other thing I wanted, when you were mentioning healthcare, was the fact that what I think a lot of employees, especially new employees, may not understand, because they'll say, well, I could go work for XYZ company, and they'll pay my health insurance. It's free. It's like, yes, but what the government offers is they'll pay 75%, 72, 75% of your health insurance. But if you stay long enough to retire, you'll have that health insurance the rest of your life. Ask the company down the road if they're going to offer you lifetime health care, and chances are the answer will be no.
As well as the choices. I mean, the choices are just fantastic, and we do an awful lot of shows in the autumn on that because it's open season, and we bring a different, a fair number of providers into the show. But you know this certainly better than I, but we bring in Walt Francis, and you two talk, and I don't understand anything you're talking about.
Well, the nice thing with the choices is it's not just a variety of companies that sell health insurance. It's also types of health plans. You have several HMOs to choose from. You have fee-for-service plans, preferred provider options, and the new high-deductible health plans. You've got several choices of those as well, which I think a lot of employees, especially higher salaried employees, should look at those high deductible options. So not just the fact that you have Blue Cross, GEHA, and mail handlers, but you have different varieties of those plans, which makes it so employees can choose really what best suits their family's needs.
Sure. Now, people listening, we're live. It's about 10:16. It's Monday, June 21st. First day of summer. And we're on till about 10:58. Now, this is AM. So for those of you listening archived, don't call because we're not here. But for those of you listening live, please give us a call, 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. By the way, that's a new phone number in the last 2 weeks for those of you that might have been listening before. And you have an opportunity here to talk to the Tammy Flanagan live. And if you have any tax or finance questions, I should be able to field them, but I'll never be able to field a benefits question like you can. Let's come back to somebody that did join the federal service, maybe for the wrong reason. Let's just say they did it for the wrong reason because it was a job, which clearly is wrong because of the opportunities that you have. And then when they got a job offer for the job that they really wanted, they leave the federal sector.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of people will come into government just because they want to get some experience in the federal sector to take that experience out into private industry. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's like a stepping stone into what they want to do. But I think what you're getting to is, what do they take with them when they leave?
Yes.
And what do they give up when they leave as well? I think it's another thing to look at. Well, the one thing I think employees, if nothing else, they need to remember is what they take with them and what they don't give up is the money that they save. So if they, from day one, start contributing to the Thrift Savings Plan, they're going to get matching contributions under the changes in the law that took effect last year. So immediate matching contributions up to 5% of pay. And even if they leave 6 months after they're hired, that money still belongs to them. The only thing that has to be vested or saved in the TSP for a period of time is the automatic 1% that the agency puts in for you. That has to stay 3 years. But other than that, everything you contribute, everything that gets matched on your contributions, that belongs to you immediately, 100% vested from day one.
This might not be a fair question, but that 1% match and somebody left after a year, could they leave it sit for another two, so it would have been in three?
No.
And then take it out?
No, that's for... That goes
I didn't
back.
Think so.
Yeah, what's the nice thing about leaving that in the thrift, the fact that not everybody gets to keep that 1% when they leave, is they offset administrative expenses with those forfeited agency automatic contributions. So it helps keep the cost of the TSP low for those employees who do come in for a year or two and don't make it, you know, for the full 3 years. So we're not going to complain about that for the employees who do participate in the thrift, that they get to help keep their expense ratio low because of that.
Okay, let's say that they did leave, and for whatever reason, but then a few years, number of years later, they go, you know, this wasn't my best move.
Coming back.
Could I come back? Assuming that we could come back, what are some of the things that we should be mindful of when we leave and when we come back?
Well, the other piece of, you know, we had started off the conversation talking about the retirement benefit. You know, besides the thrift savings plan, the company 401k plan, we also have a pension benefit, a federal retirement benefit. Now, that one takes a little longer to become vested. It takes 5 years. So once you've got 5 years of service, whether you had 2 years in the 70s and 3 years now, or whether it's 5 years continuous, doesn't really matter. If you can accumulate over the course of your lifetime 5 years or more service, you'll have a retirement benefit. So coming back to federal service might allow you to become vested and become eligible for an immediate retirement as well.
Great. We have a caller. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Hello. Hello, hello.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Good morning, caller.
Good morning. Hello?
They're not there.
Oh, hello?
A little technical
Maybe
difficulty.
They'll call back. Please call back. Yeah, Dorothy's waiting for your phone call. And I didn't introduce Dorothy, the efficient engineer. All righty. So if they come back, they need 5 years federal service. And like you say, it really doesn't make any difference. Now, is there a certain type of service, though? Does it have to be, quote, covered, end of quote? Does it have to be permanent?
Yeah. There's some buzzwords. You have to have retirement coverage. Because I was, tell you a little story real quick. I was at a seminar one time, and this gentleman was there who was in his 60s. And he was there to find out how he could collect his federal retirement. He says, I've been here for 7 or 8 years, and my personnel office keeps saying I'm not eligible to retire. And it's like, how could that be if I've been here 7 or 8 years? And so luckily the personnel office was across the hall. So at the lunchtime, we went over and talked to the specialist, and I was kind of curious also to know why, because you only need 5 years if you're 62, and he was over 62. Well, the fact was he had been hired under temporary appointment, which had no retirement coverage. The only thing he was paying into was Social Security. And you can be a federal employee and not necessarily be covered as a permanent position with retirement coverage. So even though he'd been here 7 or 8 years working for the government as a federal employee, he was not entitled to retirement. So you got to make sure when you look at your leave and earnings statement, or when you look at your personnel action statement when you're hired, there's a little box that says retirement. Make sure it says either code K or FICA plus FERS. If it doesn't say FICA plus FERS, it only says FICA, you may not have retirement coverage. Or CSRS if you happen to still be under the old system.
Okay, now that withholding, let's say that somebody left after 5, 10 years, and that money built up to be something. Mm-hmm. Is it advisable for them to, they can take that money with them when they leave?
Yeah, the contributions that employees make into both civil service and FERS is your money. So if you leave federal service and you want to take those contributions out as a refund, they'll give you a refund. And what's going to happen if you take that refund is two things. Number one, you've just given up your entitlement to a retirement benefit unless you do come back to federal service. And if you do get rehired and come back to federal service, you'll have to pay the money back plus interest. So depending on how certain you are that you're not coming back and how close you are to becoming eligible for the retirement, I would generally recommend under the FERS system not to take the refund. I mean, it's not going to be that much money anyway. If you've got 5 years or more service, you're going to be eligible for something to show for that 5, 10, 15 years of service if you leave that small contribution in there. I think it's worth considering leaving it alone.
And if somebody had a short period of time, 5 years or better, that would qualify, do they also qualify years from then for the health care coverage?
Only the health insurance has two requirements to be able to keep it as a lifetime benefit. The first one is you have to be able to be eligible to retire with an immediate retirement. That means you're old enough, you have enough service, you can retire the month after you leave. So in order for someone to continue health benefits, they would have to come back to federal service, get reinstated, and then work long enough to actually retire. And then you have to have the health coverage for 5 years before you retire to keep it.
Oh.
So you get 5-year tests, so to speak, and you have to be eligible for what's known as an immediate retirement.
Okay, that's good.
But it's doable.
To know.
Yeah, and a lot of people do return to federal service for that benefit.
Okay, well, the caller actually, I believe, emailed in, and it's a CSRS offset question, and said that the person had read that it is possible to retire and not use my benefit under the Social Security component of CSRS offset. Could that be deferred drawdown of the Social Security and use my spouse's benefit, who is younger?
Okay, let me give a little background on this first, because unless other than the person who wrote this, no one else is going to know what we're talking about. So first of all, what is civil service offset? We have two major retirement systems in federal government. We have the old civil service system, around since 1920, single benefit plan. And we have the new FERS system, new 20-some years old, but we still call it the new system, which is the one we've been talking a lot about in terms of new employees with the three-legged stool and the basic pension, the TSP, and Social Security coverage. Well, then we have people like this employee. Chances are the employee who wrote this email had a break in service. They had been under the old system for probably more than 5 years, left federal service, got rehired more recently, ever since 83. If you got rehired and after more than a year's break in service, you would now have to pay into Social Security as a federal employee, even though they're still technically CSRS. So what we're saying is that their civil service contributions are being offset by Social Security. And then likewise, when they retire, this person's civil service retirement will also be offset or reduced by the Social Security benefit that they've earned during the years that they came back to the government and paid into both civil service and Social Security. So eventually they're going to have a reduction in their civil service benefit. So what this person's saying is that when I retire, it looks like, at least I'm assuming what they're saying, is that when they retire under CSRS offset, that they have the option of, instead of applying for their own Social Security, they can defer their application and apply on their spouse's account. So if you're a married couple, you have entitlement to not only your own Social Security earned benefit, but also the Social Security that your spouse has earned for you. And you could do that. I've known people to do that. The only thing is that the offset is going to come off of your civil service retirement when you qualify for Social Security, which is generally at age 62, unless you're still working for the government. So you are going to have that reduction in civil service benefits at age 62 if you're retired by then. If you choose to apply for your spouse's Social Security, it's going to be a reduced benefit if you're applying at age 62, whether you apply on your spouse's account or on yours. And as much as you can get from your spouse is 50%, but if you take it at age 62, it's going to be more like 35%. Whereas collecting your own at age 62, even though it's reduced, you'll get about 75% of your own. So I don't know that there would be any benefit of applying on your spouse's account at age 62. I think I'd just go ahead and take my own. Now, the story would be different if me and my spouse were both of the full Social Security age. Let's say we didn't take Social Security when we were 62. We said we don't need the money. We're good health. We're going to wait and apply for our benefits when we're 66, the full age. If you can wait until you reach that full Social Security age where you could get 50% of your spouse's and then postpone your own until you're 70, then you'll qualify for delayed credits, which could actually increase your full benefit by about 24%. Now, that's something you might want to consider. But this wouldn't be something for somebody to do at age 62. This is for someone who's looking to apply for Social Security when they're 66 or older.
Okay.
So I'm not sure that's going to help this person out, because I think they're trying to think of doing this when they're 62, at the time the offset occurs.
Okay, so they'd wait till 66, or they could wait till what, 70?
70. Yeah, the Social Security basically says, let's make a deal. You know, we're going to pay you the full Social Security when you reach that full retirement age, which today, for most people today, is about 66. For me, it's 67 because I was born a little later. I'm luckily not yet 62. So, but somewhere between 66 and 67 for those of us kind of in the planning stages of retirement. But Social Security says, hey, if you don't take it at 66 and you put it off till you're 67, 68, maybe not until you're 70, for every year that you postpone receiving it, they'll give you just an extra 8% bonus just for waiting. So if it's 4 years between 66 and 70, you can get a 32% increase in your full benefit when you turn 70. But the problem is, from 66 to 70, you didn't get anything. So you got to live long enough past age 70 to make it worth waiting. And the break-even age is probably 82, 83.
And you were telling me previously, and it's kind of like the Seinfeld show, Do-Over, so that if you did access your Social Security, say at 66, and receive the benefit, you could save that money, of course, but you'd have to pay taxes on it. And then keep it in a pot, and if you made it to 70 and still... You know, all the signs said that you have a robust, you can say, here's your money back, give me the higher number.
Yeah, you could basically rescind your application, send back what you've received, and then start over. But again, you're going to have to write a check in some cases for $150,000. So you got to make sure that, like you said, I live long enough to make it worth having sent that check and get the higher benefit from here on out.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a risk.
And you would have had to pay taxes on Social Security. It's very difficult to explain what level. Well, this is an odd thing that'll happen. Let's say you pay back $100,000, $50,000, just, you know, whatever the audience picks as a number. In that year that you pay it back, you get to deduct it as a miscellaneous itemized deduction. It might not do a thing for you on the return, but it is deductible there. And that's how they say, well, this is how we'll make up for the taxes you pay. So it would be an opportunity then, if you had the ability to trigger income into the year that you have this huge deduction, it might make some sense. And I'm getting way out there with taxes. But somebody asked me that about 2 years ago, and I never thought, well, yeah, they have paid taxes. And I looked it up, and there is a provision for
There's a way to do it. Yeah, I guess the reason why most people don't do that is because most people live on their Social Security benefit. They're not able to put it in a bank and save it. But if you have that luxury, certainly something to consider, especially if you're enjoying good health.
Alrighty.
That takes us away from the new employees, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. All right. So let's get back to maybe those. In your article, there was a paragraph that says, Social Security is a tilted system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you just look at that, you go, huh? And your head tilts. And what do you mean it's tilted? What do you mean by tilted?
If you know nothing else about Social Security than what that means, you're ahead of the game. And I explain this, especially when I do a mid-career or new employee orientation. I make sure employees understand this, because if you come to work for the government, I think in most cases you're hoping to work your way up the career ladder. And in some cases, you actually start off making a fairly nice salary. Consider the fact that the average U.S. wage is about $44,000. So if you're making above $44,000 a year, you're making above the average U.S. salary. And the way Social Security works is if you work your career at a high wage, an above average wage or a higher wage, $65,000, $100,000 or higher, you're considered a high wage earner. And Social Security is set up to the fact that they're assuming that if you make enough money to cover your living expenses and have money left over, that what do you think you'll do with that money? Hopefully save it for your retirement. Where if you make below $44,000 or below the average U.S. wage, you probably didn't have much money left over after paying your living expenses to save for retirement, and the government knows that, and they've made a provision for that with the Social Security system to provide you a basic source of income so you won't be in poverty in your older years. So it's a tilted system that provides a greater replacement of earnings for people who had lower wages. It provides a lesser replacement of your earned income if you work at a higher wage, because that theory was, at least in theory, you should have been able to save more of your income. So for someone who spends their government career, GS-9, GS-11, 13, 15, don't count on Social Security for replacing more than 20, 25% of your income if you're lucky. And that's assuming nothing even changes. So in the future, if Congress does make changes, as they most likely will, and they happen to change the way the benefit's computed, I would estimate it's going to even become more tilted, because you always have to have that welfare tilt to protect those who otherwise would be on welfare if they didn't have Social Security. So I think it is important for especially brand new employees to understand that, and not necessarily discount Social Security altogether, because it has a wonderful disability provision. It has a survivor benefit program that can come in real handy if something should happen mid-career. But as far as a retirement benefit, I don't think it was ever meant to be. And for people with higher wages, you really do have to be responsible for saving a lot of that yourself. And that's more important today than it ever was before for people who want to have a retirement life. You know, it's a kind of a, you know, new century phenomena. You know, back in the 30s and 40s, I don't think people planned on living a life of cruises and life on the beach and things like that. But I think today we've become accustomed to seeing that lifestyle in the media, and that's what we want.
All righty. Now, if one is looking at joining the federal sector, could they look over their shoulder and say, do I have any prior federal service? Now, I'm talking about maybe working for the post office and holiday time,
or
national parks in the summer, or the military.
Yes.
Is it just any time?
Well, everything in federal service is potentially creditable. And you have to remember that there's a service computation date that's calculated when you're hired that's going to reflect, you know, the day you started, and they'll back it up to reflect, you know, seasonal work for the post office or time you served in the military. And that service computation date's calculated when you're hired to determine if you get 4 hours of annual leave or 6 hours or even 8 hours of annual leave when you first start working for that new agency. But as time goes by and you start thinking, well, maybe I'm here for the long haul and I want to think about retirement, there's a retirement service computation date. And that date is computed a little differently. In order to count your military service for retirement purposes, especially under FERS, you have to make a military service deposit. You have to pay into FERS in order to count that time. Otherwise, you don't pay the deposit, the time doesn't count. For instance, yesterday I ran into a guy who had served 8 years in the military. He's already in his late 40s, maybe early 50s. And I said to him, I said, hey, did you pay your military deposit? He says, no, never did get around to that. In fact, he says, I'm not even sure I'm going to make federal service my career. You know, here he is 20 years into the job and still not sure he's going to make it his career. And I was like, well, it doesn't matter. I said, even if you left tomorrow, I would still say it's worth it for you to have paid that military deposit. Because what it's going to amount to, and I just estimated based on when he served and he was in for 8 years, and with all the interest, because he's going to owe a boatload of interest having already worked 20 years. But I figure he owes about $6,000 or $7,000, let's just say, $6,000 or $7,000. So he makes a one-time payment, $6,000, $7,000. That's going to add 8% of his high three onto his FERS benefit, even if it's a deferred annuity, even if it's not something where he's going to work till he's 56. So next question I said, and you can ask this to a government employee because everybody, it's not a secret. I said, how much, you know, what's your salary? You wouldn't ask that to somebody in private industry, but federal employees, you know, hey, you're a GS, whatever. So he said, I'm a GS 14. So he's making about $120,000 a year. So 8% of $120,000 is $9,600 a year, even if he left tomorrow. So he pays one time $7,000. And for the rest of his life, someone's going to give him $9,600 a year, every year, over and over and over again.
Not a bad rate of return.
You don't have to be a financial planner to figure out that's a good return on your investment. So
I was at a function Saturday night, and I met a young person at one of the service academies. Now, I believe, I'm not certain, but I believe they get paid. Now,
they get a stipend.
Is that a fair question to ask you? Does that count?
It's active duty. There has been some question over that, though, and I know there's some agencies who question it more than others. Ultimately, the decision is made by the Office of Personnel Management of whether or not that academy service counts towards retirement, and it's currently in the retirement regulations that it is creditable time in the Naval Academy, Air Force Academy, West Point, and even Commissioned Corps of the Public Health Service is considered creditable service. So, yes, they can pay a deposit. And even if they're retired from the military, even if they went on from the academy and spent a whole career in the military, since the military doesn't count that academy time as part of their military retirement, they could technically count that 4 years towards their civil service or FERS retirement by making a deposit. So, generally speaking, it's worth getting credit for.
Okay, great.
Federal service for time spent in school. Can't beat that.
Let's take a look at another benefit. Again, maybe very attractive at whatever stage of the career, but at the beginning career, life insurance. The cost of basic life insurance is shared with you and uncle. Now, how does life insurance work? Is it a multiple of your salary?
There's a couple of components to FEGLI, Federal Employees Group Life Insurance. The original FEGLI started 1954, and it's your salary plus $2,000. So if you're making $45,000, you've got $47,000 worth of life insurance. All employees, when they're first hired, are automatically enrolled in that basic life program. And that's the part that the government does contribute part of the premium. And employees of any age pay 15 cents per thousand biweekly for that coverage. So if you have $50,000, you're paying $7.50 every 2 weeks to have that coverage. And I would generally never recommend dropping the basic FEGLI. You can waive it if you want to, but I wouldn't drop it. Because number one, it floats with your salary. Every time you get a pay increase, the amount of life insurance goes up. No physical exam required. You could have had a heart attack last year and you'll still get a bump in your life insurance next year when the pay goes up. Plus, you know, heaven forbid you're ever diagnosed with a life-threatening illness where the doctor says 9 months or less is all we're giving you. FEGLI has a living benefit, which means you can become your own beneficiary of that life insurance by applying for the living benefit and using the proceeds for maybe medical treatment that your insurance doesn't cover or for the bucket list, as Morgan Freeman and who was that other actor who had that movie?
Was it Jack Nicholson?
Jack Nicholson, yeah. So you could use it for that. So it has the living benefit. It has escalating benefits as your time goes on. And if you do retire from federal service, once you're retired and age 65, that basic insurance is free. At that point, it does reduce. You lose 75% of its original value. But what's left, if nothing else, is going to pay for a pretty nice funeral. So therefore, you know, for the rest of your life, you've got that free benefit. So the basic coverage, definitely, I think, worth keeping.
So the basics, a new person or a person mid-career would want to do this, and probably they could find term cheaper on the outside, but they would want this as the base, and if they wanted more.
If they wanted more, that's when you want to kind of look between the FEGLI optional coverage versus buying private term. Mm-hmm. Because the FEGLI optional, we're talking option B. Option A is hardly worth talking about. It's $10,000. It's been $10,000 for 42 years. But option B, is where you can elect multiples of your salary. You can say, I want five times my basic pay. So here I am buying a house, starting a family. I need a lot of life insurance. I better beef it up. Nothing easier than just filling out the Fegley form within 60 days of that baby being born or getting married, and I can elect as much life insurance up to five times my salary. And it's 3 cents per thousand biweekly if I'm in my 20s. But as time goes by, that 3 cents goes to 4 to 6 to 9 to 14 cents to 28 cents per thousand biweekly, where it gets to the point where I had an employee in my seminar a few weeks ago who brought his leave and earnings statement up. And he was paying $462 biweekly for option B. That's over almost $1,000 a month for life insurance. And he says, I'm so glad you talked about this. He says, I've been wondering what this withholding is for. I'm like, wouldn't you have asked somebody by now? But what had happened was he was getting up in age, never really bothered to reevaluate carrying that much life insurance. He's still carrying five times his salary in his late 60s, maybe early 70s. I'm not sure how old he was. But I would say if you're insurable, and you know that you've just had a child who's hopefully going to need your finances for the next, you know, 18 to 20 years, maybe longer, maybe go out and buy a 20-year level term policy. You know, buy enough that's going to pay off your mortgage and put the kids through school, get them to that point in life. You're going to need a lot of insurance for that time in your life. But once those kids are gone and once the mortgage is closer to being paid off, your needs aren't going to be the same. And so if that term expires, so be it. You know, maybe convert a little bit to whole life or maybe keep a little Fegley in the bank. But Fegley, the benefit to Fegley option B is that it covers everybody in the federal group, regardless of their health. And so therefore, as your age goes up, you can be covered for the rest of your life, but you're going to pay for it based on your age. So every 5 years, the premium goes up on option B, and it gets very expensive as time goes by.
Well, let's say we're fortunate enough to live. But we are disabled. Is there some type of disability insurance built into the system that's automatic? And is there a disability package that's not automatic, but with a cost?
Well, I always tell federal employees, I say, did you realize you have short-term and long-term disability protection? And they look at each other like, what do you mean? We don't buy disability insurance. The government doesn't, for the most part, sell us disability insurance coverage. And I say, no, I said, they don't call it disability insurance. They call it sick leave and disability retirement. Because with your sick leave, you accumulate 104 hours a year. And if you're lucky enough to be healthy to save it up, you can accumulate it from year to year. So after having worked for the government for 10 years, you've accumulated the equivalent of 6 months of paid leave.
So there's no use-lose with sick leave?
Not with sick leave. No, if you work 20 years, you've accumulated a year of sick leave. Not that you would have that on the books, because most people have to take it now and then. But the point is that after working, you know, halfway through your career, if you should be diagnosed with an illness or if you're in a car accident, you're going to be off work for 3 months or 6 months. If you're lucky, you don't have to worry about where the money's coming from, because your sick leave is going to carry you through. And, you know, it's, most agencies make use of the leave bank, where people can donate their excess annual leave and help you if you run short. But being able to save up your sick leave is very valuable. I always tell new employees that's your short-term insurance.
So then that individual, if they were looking at a disability package, would maybe find the one with the least premium, because the lower premium is directly related to the time that you become disabled and then when you ask the insurance company for the benefit. And if you're saying that there would be significant coverage, depending on how much sick leave you used, it would, the cost of the disability package would be that much less.
I guess that was how you'd price it. But when it gets to long-term disability, both FERS and CSRS employees have disability retirement. So if you're in a situation where your sick leave is almost gone, you're facing leave without pay, and your illness is not getting any better, looks like you're going to be out of work for at least a year, if not permanently, then you have the option to apply for retirement at any age. There's no age requirement, very little service requirement. The main condition is that you have to show the Office of Personnel Management of how it is that this disability is preventing you from doing your job. And your agency has to try to accommodate you, if at all possible, in another job of the same pay grade or in the same job if they can make modifications. But if that's not available, then the disability may be approved. Now, at the same time, when you apply for FERS disability, you also have to apply for Social Security. And Social Security disability's definition is a little bit more strict, because it says not only are you disabled from your current job, but you're disabled from any job. So sometimes you can get the FERS disability, which might replace about 40% of your pay. And you're not going to get that extra benefit from Social Security because you may not be severely enough disabled. So in a situation like that, if you're able to work part-time or do some other type of work, you can still work and earn a salary and still collect disability retirement. OPM's limit on your wages is limited to 80% of what you were earning as a federal employee. So you can still have a fairly significant salary to supplement that disability retirement if you are considered disabled from your federal position.
Let's say that somebody was unfortunate enough to be totally disabled and they were entitled to collect Social Security benefits, but their benefit on the job is greater than what the annual Social Security benefit would be, the disability retirement. Do they subtract their Social Security from the disability retirement?
No. Well, part of it. When you get to your full disability, which is a year into your disability through FERS, I'm using FERS because most employees now in that situation would be under FERS, that 40% benefit would be offset by 60% of your Social Security. So you'd have some Social Security and the FERS benefit offset. So between the two, it would still be more than 40%.
Okay.
Yeah. And then at age 62, they recalculate the whole thing as if you had worked until you were 62. So for some people, they'll actually get a little bit more money once they make it past age 62.
Does a spousal survivor's annuity tie into a disability annuity? So in other words, if somebody was receiving a disability annuity, forget the Social Security for just a sec, is there a spousal?
When you retire, you can elect a survivor benefit for your spouse, which is going to cause your benefit to be reduced, but you can still do that. Here's the other thing that's kind of tied to this. We don't like to think about this, but if an employee were to die in service, you know, let's say I never made it to retirement, never got around to the disability application, and something happened to this employee before they had a chance to retire, your family has benefits that you may not even be aware of. Under FERS, your spouse would be entitled to a basic death benefit, which is equal to half of your annual salary rate, plus a lump sum payment, which this year is around $30,000. That's just a cash payment. On top of that, a surviving spouse, if the employee had 10 years of service or more, would get an annuity of 50% of your FERS retirement that you had earned as if you had retired the day you died. And that's a lifetime payment to a surviving spouse. You've never elected it. It's just there. If you have dependent children, they would most likely get Social Security if they're still in grade school or high school. Once they're out of high school, OPM pays a child's benefit through age 20, up until age 22 if they're still in school and unmarried. And that would provide each child with approximately another $500 a month per child if you have the dependent children. On top of that, you have beneficiary designations. Who's going to get your TSP money? Who's going to get your life insurance? Who's going to get any unpaid compensation you still have on the books? And if you're not married and don't have dependent children, who's going to get the money you've paid into FERS? So we have a lot of benefits there for an employee who dies in service that are something, like I said, who wants to dwell on that, but it's important for estate planning purposes and even in determining how much life insurance you want to carry to know that you have those benefits, because I find that there are some people who are probably overinsured, have more insurance than they really need to cover, you know, the financial security of their families.
All right, which then brings us to the TSP. The last Monday, we did a show, and Tom Tribuco, the Director of External Affairs
TSP. Oh, yeah, and I hurried up and listened to that show. That was a good
so
one.
So was I,
it
and
was
I was
one.
Here, yeah, and Mike Causey was here, and he talked about legislation on the horizon, good, bad, or otherwise, and John Elliott, Federal Benefits Whiz.
Or Bob Elliott.
Bob Elliott, yeah, right, Jim Bob Boy. So, Tom had some just great things to say, but you wrote an article last Friday in GovExec.
I asked Tom for permission if I could summarize everything from the show, and I wrote about those changes in my GovExec column. But I thought they were interesting because the changes actually were passed into law a year ago in June. So it's now been a year, and we're implementing these changes. So I think employees would be interested to know of how those changes are getting put into place. So that was a good summary, a good update of what's happening.
Yeah, this new employee, because we're trying to tilt the show a little bit to entice people to come to work for the feds. Again, not just for the benefits, for the job first, benefits second, career third. Immediate employer contribution for new hires. Yep. That was not the case
period before.
No,
you had to wait. In some cases, you had to wait a year before you got employer contributions, depending on the timing of when you were hired. So some people were lucky enough they'd get contributions 6 months after they were hired. Those not so lucky would have to wait a year. That's gone. Now you get immediate employer contributions when you sign up for the thrift. When you contribute, you get matching agency funds from pay period one. And starting in August, as Tom was saying, payroll systems are going to be geared up. When they hire new employees, they're going to automatically deduct 3% from their pay to put into their TSP account, which will be matched 100% G fund. And employees can do one of two things. They can either put more money in and diversify into the other funds, or if they really are set against a thrift savings plan, they can ask for that money to come back. They got to do it within 90 days and they can withdraw. Yeah. I'm hoping not too many people decide to take the money back out, because I think it's just a wonderful opportunity to make up for that tilt to Social Security. You got to do something. If you think you're going to work forever, your health may not let you. Sometimes you have to plan for the unexpected.
And another thing, and this would certainly benefit the new folks as well as some people that I may 20, 30 years into it, there's automatic enrollment now. And at some of these pre-retirement, mid-career, I don't have a thrift. Why not? Well, I never saw the benefit from it. Well, now it's automatic.
Right.
And there was some quote, I guess, by Tom that 400,000 people that work for the feds don't participate in it.
Yep. 16% of the workforce has non-participation. So hopefully that's going to go up once this automatic enrollment kicks in, because I've even talked to new employees, and I had a friend of my son's told me that he wasn't going to contribute because he wasn't sure he was going to make federal service his career. And I said, that's not a good excuse. I says, whether you make federal service your career, you work in private industry, no matter where you work, you're going to have a savings plan, whether it's a 401k or a TSP or a 403b, and that savings is going to follow you throughout your lifetime. And if you play your cards right and you consistently save, even if it's 5% of your pay for the next 30 years, you won't be sorry.
Yeah, and if you put it in numerical terms, when somebody starts to, I mean, people aren't thinking about retirement when they're 21, but they ought to be having it kind of on the side somewhere. But when it comes to last day to work, we have a guaranteed pension here. We got Social Security, if FERS or offset. We have thrift, et cetera. But on the outside world, if there isn't a pension, picture what somebody needs at a certain age. Let's say it's 55 or 60. For every $1 million that they saved and grew, every $1 million, if they took 3.5% or 4% out, 4% is probably edging up a little bit. I tend to be ultra conservative. Take 3.5% of $1 million. That's $35,000. Somebody saying that now, so that's not too bad. We're talking years from now. Mm-hmm. It's not good. So no. What would it take if things doubled? It would take $2 million. It's very hard to do if you just try to take it and write a check and save it someplace. But if it's kind of taken from you and matched, how good is that?
Yep. Yeah, that's what I tell people, too. Their FERS retirement, depending on your salary and how much service you have, but let's say that provides $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 a month income. How much would you have to have in an investment to provide a lifetime stream of income of $2,000, $3,000, or $4,000 a month with a COLA after age 62? That would take at least $1 million. By your calculation, probably a little more.
Yeah.
So you've just saved yourself from saving that much money by having that proverbial company pension, which federal employees do have.
And somebody listening might say, oh, come on, how am I ever going to save that much? But we got, Tom gave us some stats, and I think you put them in your column as well.
Yeah, I put them on GovExec,
everybody can talk about the millionaires, but they're not that many of them. But what did you call them, the half millionaires?
The half millionaires. Yeah, there's over 10,000 half millionaires.
And remember,
there probably would be a lot more if it wasn't for 2008.
Yeah.
So we have to keep that into perspective that, we did have a time of recovery that we're still going through. So I think in a few years, those numbers are going to look a lot more promising.
And some of you saying, oh, yeah, those are the people that have been in it since forever. Well, forever doesn't go back that far.
No.
When was the first year the thrift came
87.
Out? 87.
It's 23 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not a career. 23 years does not make a career. According to Social Security, a career spans from age 22 to 62, more like 40 years. So when you start compounding those last 13 years on top of the 27, we're going to have a lot more millionaires come 13 years from now.
Yeah,
but the thrift plan just hasn't been around that long. And the people who do have $1 million in there have it because they transferred it from somewhere else. So if you don't have even a half a million, don't feel bad.
Yeah. And by the way, for those of you all that are listening, when Tammy just mentioned that, money can be transferred into the thrift from a prior employer's 401k plan. And in fact, if you have an IRA that has a taxable component, you can transfer IRA money into the thrift. So sitting
what
down.
What would be the advantage of doing that?
The earning power. So if somebody was to say my IRA isn't doing as well because I don't have good advice or I'm trying to do it myself, but if I put it over here on, I won't say automatic pilot because you should look at what's in your thrift, it would be the earning power. I mean, if they both were invested in the same thing, you know, let's say the C fund is very common outside the thrift, but it's inside the thrift and a dollar's in there and a dollar's in an IRA, there isn't a bit of difference in 20, 30 years. Mm-hmm. But you have the ability to do other things with it that you might not otherwise do on your own. If you happen to be a fantastic investor, then you probably should leave the money in the IRA. Most people are not, it's a very small percentage of the population. So the thrift offers you the opportunity to invest in certain funds. No, it's not limitless. Or to put a quote on automatic pilot, the financial planners are going to cringe when I say that, but the life cycle funds where somebody else is kind of watching out and you're picking a target date on which to accumulate a certain amount of money.
Well, I we all know I'm not a financial planner, but I'm a wannabe.
You're a closet financial planner. You've told me that.
But I just can't understand, because when I talk to employees at seminars, and I'll even ask them for a brief definition of the C, F, G, S, and I funds, and the majority of people couldn't tell you what they are. They couldn't tell you that the C fund is the S&P 500. They don't know that it's all U.S. stocks and large companies. They really don't even have that basic knowledge. And so if you're someone who really doesn't understand, doesn't want to understand investing, doesn't have any desire to understand it, but you do someday want to retire, then you've got to either get some help to get there or to take the easy route, which is use the life cycle funds. There's nothing to be ashamed of if you put your money in the L funds.
No, and I was just looking before, and I better hurry up. Dorothy's giving us the high sign. The G fund did not have a bad day in the last 10 years. The F fund did not have a bad year. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, I won't say day, year. The C fund kind of rocked and rolled with the waves and didn't do that great in the last 10 years. That's not to say you shouldn't be in there.
No.
The S fund is smaller company stock, and the I fund is international stock.
I think the key is the letter D stands for diversify.
Is that what that means, or does it mean Dwayne?
Well, Dwayne is one of our financial planners, could probably help you. But you really have to be aware of the benefits of spreading your money across different buckets.
Yeah. All righty. How much time we got left? Dorothy, 1 minute. All righty. Tammy, just I have to say one thing. Dennis Damp is an individual that publishes books, and he sent us a really nice book down, Take Charge of Your Federal Career. Email us at nitpinc.com, and I can fill you in on more. Dennis knows what he's talking about.
He looks like a good guy to helping get a government job. Application,
and he's
resume
not,
writing.
It's not theory. He's a retired federal civil servant. He's with the military, et cetera, so he knows what he's talking about. Anyway, Tammy, final comments?
Take the time to learn about your benefits.
Listen to the show repeatedly. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.
WFED Washington, WW